Good evening, everybody. We're back here with Enemy Sessions. We're doing number 10. Today is December the 5th, 2011 in Hawaii. Today we're back at Inscriptorium, which is a blog prepared by Andrew McLuhan. And it works through some of the documents associated with and notation in McLuhan's own private library. And so today we're starting with August the 3rd, 2011. And the post is called Andrew Marvel, Attacked by a Tough.
Okay, it begins, stated August 3rd, 2011. Dear reader, I am now approaching my 4,000th entry. I am now, this is Andrew speaking, young man, I am now approaching my 4,000th entry into my catalog of the personal library of Marshall McLuhan. So we're not getting many of them, are we?
Well, no, presumably this is a paid project that is going into a repository somewhere, but I'm not sure what the shape or form of it is.
No, it's a paid project. It's paid by Germans. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, no, Gerald O'Grady told me it's Peter Weibel, or however you say his name, mm-hmm. And I guess O'Grady is part of it. They're paying Eric/Andrew.
Great.
Maybe they're going to use it in their McLuhan centenary thing in 2012. Maybe there's some. It's a supplement to that, which they announced. You know, Dark Matter sent me a post. They're talking about it, but they spelled Gerald O'Grady's name wrong. Jim writes to me, pathetic. Okay, so...
I'll read and you can hear it and maybe it'll spark some ideas.
Well, can I read?
Yeah, go for it. You're a better reader.
Right, did you just say you wanted to read?
Oh, I was going to read if perhaps you wanted to sit back and relax and listen.
No, I'm a better reader, I think.
Yeah, I concur.
Okay, more than a task, this journey has been filled with excitement and discovery with every box I open. I never know what I will come across, and some of what I've come across has been truly astonishing. I have found a typed letter from Ezra Pound tucked in a book, pictures of Marshall McLuhan and his family from years gone by, postcards and mementos from trips abroad, notations which speak to intellectual progress from the University of Manitoba to the last years of the Center for Culture and Technology, name tags and folders from conferences, strange, incomprehensible things mailed from admirers. In the process, I have learned much about so many subjects, seen a bit into the way a brilliant mind worked, began to have an understanding of McLuhan's work, and had the amazing opportunity to learn all this about my grandfather, an opportunity which few ever had. In short, it's been an honor which I will never forget. My only regret with this project is that I don't have the time or the resources to thoroughly document each volume of interest, perhaps 90% of them, but that would be more of a lifetime's work. I estimate that I have maybe another 1,000 books to catalog, and when I get to the end, so will this weblog reach its end. In the meantime, there's more to share with you, faithful reader. Now, he's saying 4,000 entries. I guess that means 4,000 book, right?
Yeah, presumably. I don't know what their system of documentation is and what exactly they are documenting.
Okay, the volume is, quote, Andrew Marvel, unquote, by M.C. Bradbrook and M.G. Lloyd Thomas, and it contains the invoice from Cambridge University Press to Marshall McLuhan, Esquire, Department of English, University of St. Louis, Missouri, USA, dated 29 October 1940. That's just Carolyn coming in. Tucked between pages 46 to 47 is an air letter, quote, air letter, unquote, addressed to Professor H.M. McLuhan and originally addressed care of the Vanguard Press, Incorporated, 424 Madison Avenue, New York, but that's crossed out and has been readdressed to 81 St. Mary Street, Toronto, Canada, and has a postmark for Cambridge and a New York postmark dated May 19, 1952. The letter is typed with some pen corrections and begins 16-5-52, I guess that would be May 16, 1952, Girton College, Cambridge. So, who's writing this letter? Is this Bradbrook? Now, do you remember the talk about Muriel Bradbrook? She got mentioned occasionally. Do you remember?
The name is familiar, but I'm not entirely sure what context.
Okay, he respected her. She may have commented on his PhD thesis in one of the biographies, like someone interviewed her. I think we're going to have to be careful here.
Is that Muriel Bradbrook?
Yes.
I've got him in 1975. He's still corresponding with her.
Still corresponding. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but she was some kind of scholar that he... maybe it was in a Renaissance review. He respected some contribution she made. Or have you got his biography there?
The McLuhan's?
Yeah, any one of the biographies.
I've got... I think I've got both of them here, actually. One second.
Yeah. She may have been even a student over there when he was there in the 30s.
Yeah, I've got it now. Anyway, as an aside, McLuhan writes to Muriel C. Bradbrook on the 24th of July, 1975, Shakespeare had fun with the dialectic and logic chopping as a Puritan ploy for disengaging with the world of matter. Dialectic, as a means of engaging the world of pure spirit without the pollution of matter, has a strange history indeed.
That's what he wrote to Muriel.
Yep.
But what's it say in the biography, the earliest entries?
Not in the Terence Gordon one. She's not listed.
Okay, how about Phil's?
That one's at work. I don't have that ready to hand.
Okay, so she writes, "Dear McLuhan," interesting, eh? Didn't call him Marshall. "Dear McLuhan," it's like, I don't know, it's like friends from school. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're younger, you would call people by their last name, maybe. "Thank you so much for The Mechanical Bride. I enjoyed it immensely, and so did my students. Didn't the advertisers mind their stuff being used in this manner? Good question, because they did mind it." You know that story.
Yeah, but I think it was part of the rationale is that it was actually on account of the copyright. You could just simply, it was public material.
Oh, yeah, that's what was understood. But did you ever hear, did I ever tell you how the advertisers went after McLuhan anyways?
No, I never heard about that. I've always wondered about it, but I've never followed it up.
It might have been Don Thiel. Somebody back from those days told me that they really caused a problem at either Vanguard Press or something. They didn't take it lightly. They were like probing. Maybe they thought they could make a case out of it because they saw.
Who's the they? Is that one of the big houses in New York City or something like this?
Yeah, maybe the Advertisers Association, whatever it would be, the guild, somebody in the advertising world went after this book. Even though McLuhan understood, or somebody understood, that it was legal to do what he did. But see, that they probably never thought of anybody doing it. And then when someone did it, they said, "We got to put a stop to this." So they tried to get a case against him. And I assume they didn't, but I don't know what came out of that. Okay, so then she continues. "Yesterday I had a letter from a firm which does duplicating, which began without any preamble, quote, 'A Negro was walking along a Chicago street when he was attacked by a tough. He prayed, quote, 'Oh God, don't let this tough get me,' unquote. And a piece of cornice at once fell off a roof and brained the tough. Whereat the grateful Negro exclaimed, quote, 'Lord, that's what I call service,' unquote." Just like that, she says. And then they go to their advertising matter. "I have never seen anything so shocking." She's finding it shocking that the firm has this story without the letter from the firm that does not have any proper easing into it. Right?
Yeah, I'd assume so. That just no beginning, no end, just launches straight into the middle of the action.
You seem to be managed to put in quite an incredible amount of work. How is it done? I find myself getting slower and slower, and this year a couple of articles have gone near to squeeze. And this year a couple of articles have gone near to squeeze all the energy out of me. One for the year's work in English studies and one for Shakespeare Survey. In 1950, over 300 books, articles, and notes on Shakespeare saw the light. He is overstudied. Academics should be allowed to publish only under license when he is their subject. This, of course, is envy, she says. I believe Basil Wiley is going back to the USA for a short visit next year, and Tom Henn is also going over. The Bennetts have been in Chicago for 6 months, and I think they have greatly enjoyed it. What are the chances of your coming to England? We are flooded with Fulbrights, but see so few Canadians. Yours ever, Muriel Bradbrook. Sounds like a very close friend, eh? Talking about people they knew. And then Andrew says, also include the volume or a card, quote, with the author's compliments, in brackets, Miss M.C. Bradbrook, and a postcard, which on the reverse, Marshall wrote, quote, back of Girton College from Miss Bradbrook, who also gave us our copy of Bay's Rehearsal. So what is this?
The issue that I want to pick up, though, is this idea of energy and work, because that's it's one that has struck me as quite significant.
Well, what, someone noticing Marshall's energy?
Yeah, that he's got this energy and he continued to have energy all the way back through. Like, right back in Typhoon in America, there's he's almost addressing this issue of energy and workfulness. He says, when the interrelatedness of particulars is made plain, the mind is freed from watchful fretting. Far from being exhausted by such, and I've skipped out a bit, the mind develops more zest. The writing of this book, for example, was fun, and it was intended to provide fun. And so it's kind of interesting that in this letter that we're looking at here, it's we've got Bradbrook she's locking down this this overstudied Shakespeare. She's got worry and grief, and it's actually working against her capacity to have energy and ongoing outputs.
Yeah, because, it's obsolete what she's doing, and Marshall's just having fun and making stuff up, and that'll give you energy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a significant thing. Maybe it's a personal thing, but it's I think a lot of people struggle with this issue of energy and how you actually create it, generate it, harness it, and dedicate it towards a particular project.
Well, I'm a perfect example of understanding how to use my energy or not even be concerned about it. I've got infinite energy, but it's because I don't have to do any bureaucratic work, like write reviews in my special field of Shakespeare or something.
The mind is freed from from unnecessary fretting.
You have to go back and check. What's that free from again? Free from what? Unnecessary fretting?
Yeah. Free from watchful fretting. Watchful fretting.
That's right. Marshall either thought he'd have a great impact and was excited and energized by that, or didn't care what the impact was. He just found it very exciting noticing the patterns and therefore was not worried about what other people thought. But
it's kind of interesting, though, because a lot of people, when they're reading McLuhan on a shallow level, they say, well, pay attention to the present, this, that, and the other. But here you've got a slightly more nuanced orientation where it's not a watchful fretting in terms of observing the particulars of what's going on.
Good point. Yeah, you don't watch the present to see how your friends are doing or to see how you're doing in relation to somebody. You don't notice the present when you're living in the now. That's energy. You're not limited by perspectives. It's tactile space. It's tactility.
Sorry for the digression, Bob. Where were we?
I'm trying to get, also including the volume or a card. So with the author's compliments, that's Miss M.C. Bradbrook, and a postcard, which on the reverse, Marshall wrote, quote, back of Girton College from Miss Bradbrook, who also gave us our copy of Bay's Rehearsal. So why does it say the back of Girton College? Is that where her office is? Maybe he even knows he's naming where her office is on the campus. Okay, end of that quote from McLuhan's little annotation. Then Andrew says there was only one notation inside the back dust jacket. Page 17, quote, page 17, Parker's attack on Cambridge Platonists. So that's C-A-M-B for Cambridge, I assume. Thanks for reading, says Andrew Crystal. I don't get anything out of this one. What's the deal here?
No, there's not much. We could talk about Andrew Marvel.
No, I don't want to talk about him. I never liked him. He just was a useless tool. Tool of the Aristotelians. Jane McDonald responds, thanks for the wee peek, Andrew. And Youngblood Holden, who we know is a regular performer on Cashflow, writes, cool, K-E-W-L. Youngblood Holden's also a comedian, I think. One of the Holden brothers is. So, Andrew Marvel, who McLuhan, he wrote this and that about Andrew Marvel. He would mention him a lot, right?
Yeah, so, Coy Mistress, I think, is the poem of his that he uses quite a lot.
Right, so maybe... Andrew the grandson is pointing out the relationship between Muir and McLuhan around Marvel, that he got his stuff hot off the press from Muriel. He got interesting ideas about that period, those writers of that period. Anyways, I'm not inspired by anything by that thing.
Forge ahead then. Let's go to, we've just done August. Is there anything else in August?
I'm just going to put Muriel Bradbrook in Wiki. Let's see if she got any kind of stature and what her dates were. '09, so she's 2 years older than Marshall. And died in June 1993. So she lasted 84 years. Yeah, 84 years. So she, 84 years, she's 15 years longer than McLuhan. Or lived 15 years after McLuhan and 17 years longer. Was a British literary scholar and authority on Shakespeare. And she's bored by the time the 50s come around. She was professor of English at the University of Cambridge and mistress of Girton College, Cambridge. So that was her office probably at the back of the college, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to... She was educated at Glasgow. She spent a year at, when did she go to Cambridge? She went to Goodman. She was there between 1927 and 1930. And then she remained at Girton College as a Carlisle scholar. I think she had something to do with Marshall's PhD. I think she, provides something. Maybe if I get a chance, I'll check it out, and we'll supplement this if I go with my copy. Obtained her PhD in 1933. She spent a year at the University of Oxford before returning to Girton College as a lecturer in 1936, remained in Cambridge apart from a period working in London for the Board of Trade during the Second World War. By that time, she'd already published 5 major works of literary criticism, and throughout the 50s and 60s, she continued to publish on Shakespeare and the Elizabethans. In all, she wrote some 17 books, including works on Ibsen, Lowry, and Conrad. She was appointed university lecturer in 1948, a reader in 62, professor of English in 65, the first female professor in the Faculty of English. She held visiting professorships at numerous universities, including Santa Cruz, Tokyo, Rhodes, South Africa, and received honorary degrees from many more. During her period of office as mistress, Girton College celebrated its centenary, for which she wrote a history called That Infidel Place, and the decision was taken to admit men. Was this during her period of office as mistress? So that's when they decided to admit men? What the hell does this mean? She retired in 1976 and became a life fellow of Girton College. Maybe we have to read the first part. She went to Girton College, read English, remained as a scholar, and subsequently as the Ottilie Hancock Research Fellow, obtaining a PhD in 33. I think she might, she was an advisor or something to his PhD, which is important, right? So we definitely got to fill in a little bit more about her. I'll look up the biography.
Yeah, I don't know anything more about her.
During her period of office as mistress, so is that some kind of role?
Yeah, presumably. It's presumably the equivalent of a dean or something like this.
No, it sounds like running. An incision was taken to admit men. Maybe they allowed men into the women's section. Maybe that's what it means. Co-ed stuff. Okay. Sorry, Andrew, for I hope that's interesting for those, our interlocutors, our auditors. Okay, I'm ready to go on.
The meaning of the digression may become apparent or it may not. the next one is John Wayne's Hedonistic Pleasures in September 27, 2011.
Well, when I was becoming more familiar with McLuhan way back there, he made a big deal out of the novelist John Wayne. It's like almost like the only novelist he knew. And I never knew much about him. I didn't know if he was, I mean, it wasn't anybody I would read. Now, maybe he was a good author, but I never was attracted to him. So, but it turned out they were very good friends. And we never heard anything about John Wayne, right? What he had to say about Marshall.
No, I haven't got any reply letters, but I've got a couple of letters from McLuhan to John Wayne.
Oh, yeah, no, he wrote to him. And they're, I think they're even in the letters, and you got some others, right?
Yep.
Okay, so let's look at this. John Wayne's Hedonistic Pleasures, September 27, 2011, is when Andrew writes this. Tucked in the back of this book called Living in the Present by John Wayne are a couple of letters and typically a few New York Times clippings relevant to the volume. There are many of Wayne's books, most if not all, in the library. And almost all are signed to McLuhan from Wayne. Many also have letters which show a warm relationship between the two based on mutual admiration. In brackets, I have to assume the admiration was mutual as I have only seen the letters from Wayne to McLuhan. And you got the ones from McLuhan to Wayne.
Yeah.
I don't think any of the letters have been seen by the public in quotes. The following is a transcript of a letter from Wayne to McLuhan, postmarked March 23rd, 1955, from Wayne, who is at 25 Florida Court, Reading, and maybe a place called Reading, to H.M. McLuhan, Esquire, 29 Wells Hill Avenue, Toronto, 10, Canada. Dear McLuhan, very hastily, says John, because I have a lot of other things to do just now, I send you this to acknowledge having got your parcel. Actually, I've already devoured a lot of the contents, but my brain works seasonally, as it were. Sometimes it seems to welcome critical work and do it easily, and at other times I just recoil from it. Another person with no energy. Just now I am deep in a novel, and it seems as if the resources of my mind are all going into the effort of identifying with the characters, and I just can't do critical thinking at all. Your simplest article defeats me, though I get a hedonistic pleasure from reading your prose. So if you don't mind, the thing may have to wait a few weeks before I do anything very strenuous. But if I am, I just can't do it yet. My first impression, for what it's worth, is that you would make a more unified and more useful initial impact if you wrote out your basic ideas in the form of a short book, not much longer than a pamphlet. I say initial, in quotes, not that there aren't a great many people in England who know and follow your work. In brackets, I met one only last night who, it seems, used to read you in something called View. Remember that American thing in the 40s? Mm-hmm. A man named Alloway. End of bracket. But because this would be your first introduction to the English reading public at large, okay, so he's saying, not that there aren't a great many people who know and follow your work. So he's implying that many people follow his work. And what's the date of this letter?
So 55.
So he's thinking that maybe there are people in England who know him. And it's not because of that, but because this would be your first introduction to the English reading public at large. I do have the impression that the essays could hardly be grouped in a way that wouldn't make a bitty impression. What's that mean? I do have the impression that the essays could hardly be grouped in a way they couldn't make a bitty impression. I mean, maybe a bitty means little. They just would. They'd make a good impression, no matter what. Wouldn't it be best for me to show them to an intelligent publisher? I think there are some, in brackets, and use them to engage his interest so that he will then be the more easily persuaded to commission a short book from you. That's what I think now. Anyway, I'll let you know, / developments. Best wishes, yours, John Wayne. P.S. Would you have any objection to one of your essays appearing in a magazine called Mandrake? It doesn't pay, but is very chic. Thanks, as ever, for reading. Signed, Andrew Crystal. And then Andrew Crystal fakes a response. He makes up a name called Graham Larkin. And Larkin writes, good stuff, Andrew. Good stuff, Mr. Crystal. It's nice to see that passing reference to the impresario Lawrence Alloway, 1926 to 1990, a member of the independent group for whom The Mechanical Bride was essential reading. Given that... What, you going to say something?
No, it's just... I don't know anything about this Lawrence Alloway character.
Okay, given that pop art was invented in England around the time of the writing of that book, it's kind of surprising that McLuhan could write to Wayne 10 years later asking, quote, has pop art begun to catch on in England? McLuhan to Wayne, September 65, page 323 of the Book of Letters. His McLuhan's own interest in the subject was largely piqued a year before by the sensational Warhol exhibition at Toronto's Gerald Morris Gallery, which he did attend. Check the biography, page 297. So, has pop art begun to catch on in England? So, pop art really surfaces around 64 or 65. And so he's saying that pop art began in England. I think he's thinking of Richard Hamilton, the artist who was also a Duchamp scholar. Mm-hmm. So let's assume the independent group is a pop art group. And the art world was not paying attention to England in North America. They were paying attention to New York. So there could be occasional... By the way, I think there was some Richard Hamilton work in the British Museum, with the British Tate, the old one, not the new one, where the Vorticist exhibition was this summer. And there was a Richard Hamilton. He was part of something I saw. Maybe he was part of the collection as you enter. But I know about Richard Hamilton because Dennis Young was a professor at the Art College of Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. He was a friend of Richard Hamilton's, and I come to think of it, they were touring Canada with the Duchamp's Green Box, I think, and Dennis met with McLuhan around 67. I'm thinking now that it was him and Hamilton that went and met McLuhan. And Hamilton is considered one of the first pop artists in the 50s. And Alloway is that generation born in the 20s. Who surfaced in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, as the post-abstract expressionist. So that's Graham Larkin. He's interesting. It's nice to see that passing around. So Graham Larkin seems to know about British art history, and he's curious. He thinks it's surprising McLuhan to write to Wayne saying, have you heard of pop art? See, McLuhan didn't know that he was influencing pop art or that generation that would do that kind of art.
Yeah, well, I guess in McLuhan's mind, I think if I understand correctly, he understands as pop art is that which is that art which makes us, you know, like an art form of an old advertising, and so it's with TV. So it's anything that's post-TV art that is dealing with the old, earlier advertising materials of the newspaper and magazine.
And the movie world. And you're saying I don't get what you're saying. You're saying that...
I'm just saying that, like, this other guy may be using pop in another context. I doubt McLuhan would have recognized possibly what this guy is calling pop art as pop art, according to right. his categorization.
It was Richard Hamilton's famous work, if I recall, was like a suburban living room with all kinds of collage of vacuum cleaners or something, very colorful collage. But having a painting with modern suburban artifacts in the home, I think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you probably can Google it. Let me just see. Richard Hamilton, and then maybe they'll show his famous painting. And it was definitely a 50s thing. Okay, so then there he is. He's born in 1922. And there's the picture. If you go to Wiki, you see the picture. And this 1956 collage. It was titled, "Just What Is It That Makes Today's Home So Different, So Appealing?"
You see? Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with this image. Croker's used it, hasn't he?
No, not Croker, but it's around, you know, it's quite used a lot. And so you got a bodybuilder, you got a 50s fashionable person in a hairdressing situation. Maybe it's a scene from one of a Hollywood movie. And then you got a tape recorder, modern affluence of the 50s image. So that is too collagey for McLuhan. You know what I mean? That may not be recognized by as pop art. By him. Pop art was the images of the mechanical software world. Movies and radio and... Basically, pop art was a mechanical environment as art form as we moved into the software environment, or the electronic environment. But probably McLuhan wasn't... You may be right if this is what you meant. McLuhan wasn't following the art world per se. He was watching... The mechanical world become art form and all across the board.
Yeah, so pop becomes a category as an older medium responds to a newer.
Yeah, and you have the way Warhol popularized art. He because he took pop cultural artifacts, the people were interested in it. People who weren't schooled on art history or the aesthetics of the abstract expressionists. It was a McDonaldization of art. It was taking what was cliche and familiar. So that would be something that'd be a new context for art, a new presentation of art. That's what McLuhan was commenting on. The figure of Warhol as a phenomenon in itself. And he writes about it in Through the Vanishing Point. He says, pop art is not art. It is it asks to merge with the tribal art too greatly. You know what I mean? It's not anti-environmental.
Yeah.
He says what's called pop art advocates merging with the new electronic tribal environment. So he was not impressed. And Carpenter tells the story in his background to the explorations world that he introduced McLuhan to Warhol in the early 70s, and McLuhan comes into the apartment and sees Kurt Vonnegut and Andy Warhol. And he pretends or does know or pretends he doesn't know, whatever, and he says, "Who's that?" And Ted Carpenter says, "Andy Warhol," and he goes, "Oh, that hick." Okay?
Yeah.
And then Kurt Vonnegut is pointed out, and he says, "Oh, I don't like his work." And then Ted Carpenter is commenting on that they might have heard his comments, so he didn't, McLuhan didn't help create a congenial atmosphere when he first walked in.
Yeah.
But he calls, you know, this is where Richard Cavell and the people who are art historians, they don't get the devastating destruction that McLuhan had for what we're called artists. You know what I mean? The disdain he had for them. They were only figures as good as an astronaut was, or any kind of figure for a phenomenon. It was the ground he was trying to point out. And so when when Don Thiel writes in through the vanishing, no, what's it called? The medium is a rearview mirror. He says the one value of McLuhan is McLuhan raises the value of the artist. Well, that's a dicey statement because McLuhan is seeing the obsolescence of the artist. He says in 1946 that the one ego that won't be able to handle the atomic bomb is the artistic ego. So he already said in 46 they're all going to crack up. You know what I mean? The guys who were in the traditional Gutenberg arts. So yeah. When Thiel says, look, that Marshall point out the value of art in of the artist in academic context, but it wasn't what Marshall was doing was pointing out the value of himself as the only artist around, and he wouldn't even limit himself to being called an artist or a scientist. So that the actual artist, I mean, a lot of people think McLuhan's celebrating artists. He's not. And when he says, look to the artist as a barometer of the future, you have that quote from his Project 69 in 1960 where he says, the artist, after World War II, can't be a barometer anymore.
Yeah, there's, I guess it's, there is an interesting, I guess, another way to come at that. Like, I agree with that, but this, like this, with this Hamilton painting here, and this draws me back into one of the letters that McLuhan's writing to John Wayne, because we're talking about John Wayne. McLuhan writes, I suddenly realized that the electric media create audience participation on such a scale that any public trial, the audience is the criminal. Okay, and so this is in 1970. And so, you know, around his comments around pop art, where he's saying that that art is, in a sense, anticipatory, if you dissect this painting by Hamilton, you can start to see that he already saw how the audience was going to be a criminal, is going to be indicted by the later forms.
Okay, you're saying that Hamilton saw that or McLuhan saw that?
Well, I'm not sure whether Hamilton saw it, but like that's one way of reading this painting by Hamilton. Like, look now, it's very much a "you did it" type situation. It's the ridiculousness of the human, the human actor.
Okay, don't know about that, but when you talk about the electric trial, the audience becomes the criminal. Is that what the phrase was?
Yeah.
You know what he's referring to? He's referring to the famous My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Do you know about that?
Yes.
Right. So he's saying that the audience that identified with the war effort felt they were insulted by the trial of whatever his name was, My Lai Massacre. Forget his name, Lieutenant Callie, I think it was. So you could apply that to every institution, and you hear this in all kinds of institutional contexts, where when someone from an institution makes it, the institutional members, the average humdrum people in the institution are happy, they feel represented when there was media coverage of someone from their institutions. Now, what's interesting is that the universities were not happy that one of their professors was getting acknowledged in the media, because the university is the crux of the biscuit. It's an interface. But the art world might have celebrated, or those who loved art, in the old gallery-tending form of art, when Warhol shows up, they supported Warhol because he retrieved the old archetype of the artist.
Yeah.
So the art-consuming public made Warhol famous. So is that what you're saying? You're saying something like that?
Pop art as being a post-television phenomenon. It embodies that X-ray quality of television in terms of scanning audience desire, and it does this through using old advertising and old everyday artifacts and putting them up. So in a certain sense, it's all pop art is an indictment of human appetite, and it lays it bare.
No, Marshall didn't see it that way. He saw it as advocating an appetite of merging. It quenched appetite, or it celebrated appetite, not distance from appetite.
Yeah, well, perhaps it's just me looking back at what the pop phenomenon is now. But like, I think you can easily read most of pop as an indictment of human appetite.
Okay, an indictment? No, I think it's a celebration. If you knew Warhol, unless you saw him as a clever satirist,
celebration either or, but it still puts desire and appetite front and center.
Hmm. Well, another thought I was thinking is, you know how McLuhan says in Gutenberg Gauzy, the archetypes of individual postures of mind?
Mm-hmm.
And then in Electric Age, you have the archetypes of collective postures. I was thinking of the individual postures of mind when the media focused on one, say, a celebrity from some endeavor, some institution, some Gutenberg activity, the crowd would identify with the individual posture of the mind represented by some individual. Like Warhol hoiked up the archetype of being an artist. And he always made satire of that because he always erased himself. He said he was a machine. He wants to be a machine. So I don't know, desire might be too nebulous. I think the big revolution of the 60s was people started to celebrate their appetites. That it moved out of the Calvinist, Puritan legacy of the WASP world in North America. As even Zappa pointed out, that the culture had become hedonistic. No, I think Andy Warhol was part of the move to celebrate hedonism. And that's what Marshall says. He was merging with the environment. Yeah. His art merged with the environment. So... But you're a later generation. Maybe you have a different context for it.
Well, it's a pastiche of images from that are taken from advertising that is to sell, to ignite people's passions and push them into consume.
And it's not advertising. The content of pop art was cartoons, movies. Consumer objects.
Consumer objects, which is, I guess, the end point of the advertising marketing overhaul that took place in part of the post-war reconstruction.
Right. Okay, so McLuhan advocated detachment from that.
Yes.
So, and you do that by putting your insights into a book. The book is the detaching medium. I mean, He denounces the whole enterprise with a book titled Culture is Our Business. That's if you take the literary humanist view that business is a vulgar activity. Now, I'm not saying Marshall felt that way, but could be taken that way on one level. He's ambivalent towards it. Ambivalent towards the fact that culture becomes our business. And that's a problem for the universities. At least their literary products are just one among many kinds of edification, entertaining edifications that are available.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, we're not getting into any inspired insights here, are we?
No. It's I'm sure something will come, as it always does.
Yes. Yeah, so that's is that it? That's John Wayne. Well, look, we'll come back. John Wayne's hedonistic pleasures. We're talking about hedonism.
Yeah, and so if you naturally have got complementarity in mind, it's what's the reverse of hedonism?
Denial. Living in the past. Hedonism is living in the present.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I haven't actually looked how McLuhan uses the word at all.
Right. He does say once millennial ecstatics. Millenary or millennial ecstatics, right? Remember that?
Yep.
Okay, so let's go on to... There's only one in September. So on to October. This is nothing. There's no content.
No, I think the earlier ones that we encountered were a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, you see this October 13. It says, Dr. McLuhan, you've hurt my feelings, sir. I'm not getting the image, or are you getting any content?
Yeah.
Okay, let me go over to Firefox. Maybe that'll present a better... Sometimes my Safari doesn't work.
Okay, so I'll start reading while you're searching.
No, no, you won't. I got to see what's going on. I mean, if I can't get it... See, I'm not getting it. Whoa. You're going to have to send it to me. It says... Theme Bot, Vigilance by the Theme Foundry? What's that? Oh, I popped it. No, that's Theme Showcase. Oh, no, wait. We really like this cherry tree. What is this? Cherry tree? Is that what we're looking at? Okay, you sent me something. Okay. Well, you know, your Earl did not come all the way through. But I will try it. Do you watch any TV shows, Andrew?
On an irregular basis and usually streamed.
Did you say irregular?
Irregular. Yeah, I'm not a regular television. I haven't watched television really since about 1995.
And then you said it's a strain if you do it?
No, it's usually if it's streamed. Like every now and again I'll binge on a series.
All right, well what's great is your Earl worked. It worked for me. Okay, so Dr. McLuhan, Dash, you've hurt my feelings, sir. October 13th, 2011, has an image, The Demanding Age. So we're going to find that out. So this is a... Who's the letter from? Irma Kusil?
I'm going to read it. Oh.
Okay, this is his introductions. In the Demanding, a book called The Demanding Age, an anthology of assorted contemporary literature, 1970, McGraw-Hill Book Company, edited by Ronald Side and Ralph Greenfield, there's a letter to Marshall McLuhan with curious notes on the back. In the volume is reprinted, quote, the reversal of the overheated image. So they repeat that, and there's a letter to Marshall McLuhan with notes in the back in this Marshall's copy, right? The letter is from Irma Kusil of Toronto, who was apparently connected with the Arts and Letters Club of Toronto, according to Aaron McLuhan, and reads, Dr. Marshall McLuhan, communications expert, 3 Wychwood Park, Toronto. Dr. McLuhan, I am not a cyclops nor a one-eyed monster. You've hurt my feelings, sir. Yours truly, Irma Kusil, 391 Broadway Avenue, Toronto, District 12, or Zip Code 12. And then it has a picture of the notes. The notes on the reverse are a bit hard to read, but here's my interpretation. Turd that turned Harry in ident, which might mean identity quest. Mrs. Smogbutts went into retrograde and turned turtle. For somatic somnambules and dumpus mud of quadrangular miasma. This could be a quote from Finning's Wake. The sesquilapalon bog of the labyrinth. New grammar for new garbage. Let's just see if that comes up in Finning's Wake. You know what I mean? Think we should do that?
Yep, that should be easily searchable.